eat your eggs. They're going to be cold.
There you are. Man says to his woman, I got me a dream. His woman say, eat your eggs. Man say, I got to take hold of this here world, baby. And a woman will say, eat your eggs and go to work. Man say, I got to change my life. I'm choking to death, baby. And his woman say, your eggs is getting cold. This morning I was looking in the mirror and thinking about it. I'm 35 years old and I've been married 11 years and I've got a boy who sleeps in the living room. And all I got to give him is stories about how rich white people live.
Eat your eggs, Walter.
Damn my eggs. Damn all the eggs that ever was.
A conversation between Walter and Ruth Younger in Lorraine Hansberry's groundbreaking play, A Raisin in the Sun. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In 1959, Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun became the first African-American play produced on Broadway. James Baldwin noted, "Never before in the entire history of American theater had so much of the truth of black people's lives been seen on stage." To what extent does the portrayal of the Younger family's fight to get out of their crowded, rat-infested tenement on Chicago's South Side reflect Hansberry's own experience growing up in segregated Chicago? Were there real-life counterparts to some of the characters in the play? Joining us to discuss Lorraine Hansberry is Michelle Gordon, a dissertation fellow in the Department of English and past lecturer for the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Also with us to read scenes from the play Raisin in the Sun are students from the UW Odyssey Project, Tillman Morris, Annette Bland, Yasmin Horton, Brian Benford, and Aroki Rice, as well as Odyssey Project writing coach Marshall Cook.
And welcome everybody to University of the Air, Michelle Gordon. Regarding Lorraine Hansberry, what kind of background did she have? She had to have at least some leisure time in order to write the things that she wrote.
She did have some leisure time to write, but she had actually been a journalist at Paul Robeson's Freedom newspaper first, and she was an associate editor there. She worked with people like John Killens and Alice Childress, Shirley Graham Du Bois, and she covered news like Ghana's independence, child labor, and so forth. And she actually left Freedom because she felt like she could better serve her people and the freedom struggle as a playwright than as a journalist.
Do I remember right that her father was actually a successful real estate?
Yes,
broker.
He was. They had Hansberry Enterprises, which was one of the most successful black real estate companies in the country. They owned several properties in the South Side. They were firmly middle class. They were very well known in Chicago, in black Chicago. They were also very well known in black intellectual and activist circles around the country. So not only were they important entrepreneurs, but they were also really important freedom fighters. And her house, she grew up with people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Langston Hughes and James Weldon Johnson and Paul Robeson coming through her house, and NAACP attorneys coming and strategizing how to fight for freedom. Her family actually really believed firmly in legal struggle for black rights and did things like sue the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad for their segregated Jim Crow cars that ran from the north to the west. And her uncle, this is one of my favorites, her uncle actually sued Franklin Delano Roosevelt for drafting him into a segregated army. He didn't win. And they also did things like sue Mayor Richard J. Daley, who had gotten really upset at the success of A Raisin in the Sun and its implications at how ghettoized and deliberately segregated blacks in Chicago were. And so he, in very typical Daley machine fashion, slapped Hansberry Enterprises with building violations, slumlord allegations, and over $20,000 in fines. And so then the Hansberries countersued him for impeding business practices and defaming their family name.
How did that one play out?
You know, not very well.
For the Hansberries, I gather.
Exactly. You know, Daley really ran the most powerful urban democratic machine ever. And he could pull strings in Congress, so he really had the upper hand the whole time. And they kind of knew it, but they weren't really willing to go down without a fight.
Did she grow up in a segregated neighborhood?
Yes and no. Originally, they lived in the ghetto. The South Side of Chicago had very firm borders that didn't expand as migrants were coming in and thousands of people are overcrowding this area. And basically, the entire ghetto was surrounded by what's called race-restrictive covenants. And these were legal documents that were part of the deed It said that you would not rent or sell your home to any non-white person, and often that included Jews. And so basically, they estimate that about 80% of all real estate in Chicago was covered by race-restrictive covenants by the 1940s. And so her family, recognizing being in real estate, they really recognized the desperate need for housing that blacks faced in Chicago. And so they planned, in conjunction with NAACP attorneys, to buy a house through a dummy transaction in a white neighborhood in Washington Park. And so she actually spent some time living in black Chicago, but then spent a lot of her adolescent life really on that very violent border between black and white life in Chicago.
Well, and I've heard that she was almost injured, right? When some, was it a brick that got thrown through the
house? Yes, it almost smashed her skull in, actually. They had moved in the late 1930s at the end of the Depression, and she and her sister were playing outside, and a mob showed up at their house. And this is fairly typical, what they called the welcoming committees in Chicago and other cities. And so her mother, Nanny Hansberry, was home and called her daughters inside and locked the doors, pulled the shades, all of these things, and rocks and bricks started hitting the house and breaking windows. And one of the bricks did come through the window and almost hit Lorraine in the head. And the mob stayed until a Hansberry family friend stepped out onto the porch with a shotgun. Then the mob decided to leave.
You know, when you read Raisin in the Sun or see it performed, it seems so much a celebration of the ethics of the working class family and the educated college, you know, boy, George Murchison, for example, the sort of more upper class or middle class black families do not come off well. But it's kind of funny because Hansberry really was more like the Murchison character, right, in terms of her background?
Yeah, she definitely came from that kind of firmly middle-class background. And I think it's Beneatha in the play who says that the only people more snobby than rich white folks are rich black folks. And she's really not that kind to the black upper classes and the middle classes. She saw them as being very snobby, very much about protecting what little they had. I mean, you really see some of that tension in the play. She's very critical of that. And that's, I think, a point of departure for Lorraine from her parents. And she said, actually, that when she first started to really identify with the working classes was when her mother sent her to school in the middle of the Depression in a white fur coat, and the kids beat her up. And she said from that point, she became a rebel. And pretty much throughout her life, she continued to be very influenced, but also very much set apart from these working class and proletarian class children. They saw her as very different. They labeled her a rich girl. But she really firmly believed that black liberation was going to come from the working masses. And she deliberately created the Youngers as a working class family to reflect that.
Before we hear a scene from Raisin in the Sun that sort of highlights that class distinction between Walter from the working class and a visiting college-educated young man, can you give us just a basic summary of the play itself?
Sure. Raisin is about the Younger family. They're a black family on the south side of Chicago where Hansberry herself grew up. Three generations of the Youngers live in a small apartment. It's two bedrooms. Mama, her son Walter Lee, his sister Beneatha, Walter Lee's wife named Ruth, and their son Travis. And Travis actually has to sleep on the sofa because there is not enough room, and Mama and Beneatha share a room. And basically, the plot of the play revolves around a $10,000 life insurance check. Mama's husband, Walter Sr., has passed away, and so they're eagerly awaiting the check, and basically the tension is what to do with the money. And Mama wants to buy a house. Ruth really supports that. Beneatha wants to go to medical school, and Walter Lee wants to buy a liquor store. He wants to be his own boss and an entrepreneur. This is a scene where Mama's talking to Ruth about her dream of buying a house and how old this dream actually is. It's a dream she and Walter Sr. had had for a long time, and they had never expected to be in this apartment as long as they were.
Been thinking that maybe we could meet the notes on a little old two-story somewhere. With a yard where Travis could play in the summertime. If we use part of the insurance for a down payment and everybody kind of pitch in, I could maybe take a little day work on again, a few days a week.
Well, Lord knows we've put enough rent into this here rat trap to pay for four houses by now.
Rat trap, yes. That's all it is. I remember just as well the day me and Big Walter moved in here. Hadn't been married but 2 weeks and wasn't planning on living here no more than a year. We was going to set away little by little, don't you know, and buy a little place out in Morgan Park. We had even picked out the house. Looks right dumpy today. But Lord, child, you should know all the dreams I had about buying that house and fixing it up and making me a little garden in the back. And did none of it happen.
I think besides the idea of trying to get out of this sort of rat trap kind of place, you also throughout are aware of the fact that they have to share the bathroom.
Yes.
And this is one of the kitchenette type apartments?
It is, and Ruth really explicitly addresses that in several parts, and Hansberry actually does in the stage directions, too. She says, no matter what the landlord says, this isn't actually a kitchen. And kitchenettes were and are a kind of housing, a way of housing as many people as possible in a building. And so you have these little kitchenettes that aren't really a kitchen and kind of all the living spaces all together, and very often people on a floor will have to share bathrooms with their neighbors.
I thought one of the things that you lose when you see the movie version of it is when they actually go away and look at the house. I mean, one thing about the play is you're trapped in this kitchenette with the family.
Yes.
Because everything happens in that one space, doesn't it? There's no set change.
Correct. And originally it wasn't that way, but Hansberry had cut down on street scenes and actually scenes in Clybourne Park because of time. It's interesting about the movie, though, because she recognized that film is a very different medium and she wanted to be able to use that. And the producers decided that, in fact, they didn't want her showing contrasts to how wealthy white people lived, who the Youngers worked for as chauffeurs or as maids. They didn't want her showing contrasts of mama shopping at a ghetto grocery store where she's saying, well, how come these apples look nasty and cost so much more than across the street over there? And so there's all these documents actually about how the producers decided to cut these things out. And it's also interesting, they use very passive language. It was decided that. So they completely removed their own responsibility for those decisions.
Sounds just a little bit like Mr. Linder, doesn't it, when he says, well, some people and some places do this and that and the other.
Very much so. Very much so.
One of my all-time favorite scenes in the play is the one where George Murchison comes to pick up Benita and confronts Walter.
Absolutely. It's a pretty funny scene and also in some ways fairly bitter. And you really see Walter Lee expressing his working class bitterness against wealthier blacks and what he regards as their snobbery. And you also see, in fact, George's snobbery, but also some of his sense of shame.
Why all you college boys wear them faggoty-looking white shoes?
Walter Lee?
Well, they look crazy as hell. White shoes, cozy deals.
You have to excuse him.
No, you don't. Excuse me for what? What you always excusing me for? I'll excuse myself when I need to be excused. They look as funny as them black knee socks beneath the wears out of here all the time.
It's the college style, Walter.
Style? Hell, she looks like she got burnt legs or something.
Oh, Walter.
Oh, Walter. Oh, Walter. How's your old man making out, George? I understand you all are going to buy that big hotel on the drive. Shrewd move. It's hard to find a man on this whole South Side who understands my kind of thinking. You dig? Me and you ought to sit down and talk sometimes, man. Man, I got me some ideas.
Yeah, sometimes we'll have to do that, Walter.
Yeah, well, when you get the time, man, I know you a busy little boy.
Walter, please.
I know ain't nothing in this world as busy as you colored college boys with your fraternity pins and white shoes.
Oh, Walter Lee.
I see you all the time with the books tucked under your arms going to your classes. And for what? What the hell you learning over there, filling up your heads with the sociology and psychology? But they teaching you how to be a man? How to take over and run the world? They teaching you how to run a rubber plantation or a steel mill? No. Just to talk proper and read books and wear them faggoty-looking white shoes.
You're all whacked up with bitterness, man.
And you? Ain't you bitter, man? Ain't you just about had it yet? Don't you see no stars gleaming that you can reach out and grab? You happy? You contented son of a bitch. You happy? You got it made? Bitter? Man, I'm a volcano.
One of the things that's really interesting, I think, in this scene is that Hansberry's really critiquing Walter's vision of what it means to be a man. You know, according to Walter's definition about how to be a man means how to take over and run the world. And she really doesn't see black liberation as being just taking the power and inverting the whole power structure. She really sees it as reorganizing the system. So when Walter Lee's asking about, you know, do you know how to run a rubber plantation or a steel mill, Hansberry finds that intrinsically problematic because those are exploitive of other human beings, no matter the color of the individual who's doing the running of those plantations and steel mills. And I think that's a really important part of her overall capitalist critique of American society. And she basically says that to get black people out of the mess that we're in, you have to fundamentally change the structure of American society. She really believed in socialism as a fundamental human right. So she isn't just critiquing George in this scene. She's really critiquing Walter Lee as well.
More from the play A Raisin in the Sun when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
April 23rd, 1964. To the editor, New York Times. With reference to civil disobedience and the Congress of Racial Equality Stalin. My father was typical of a generation of Negroes who believed that the American way could successfully be made to democratize the United States. Thus, 25 years ago, he spent a small personal fortune, his considerable talents, and many years of his life fighting, in association with NAACP attorneys, Chicago's restrictive covenants in one of the nation's ugliest ghettos. That fight also required that our family occupy the disputed property in a hellishly hostile white neighborhood in which, literally, howling mobs surrounded our house. One of the missiles almost took the life of the then 8-year-old signer of this letter. My memories of this correct way of fighting white supremacy in America include being spat at, cursed and pummeled in the daily trek to and from school. And I also remember my desperate and courageous mother patrolling our house all night with a loaded German Luger, doggedly guarding her 4 children while my father fought the respectable part of the battle in the Washington court. The fact that my father and the NAACP won a Supreme Court decision in a now famous case which bears his name is, ironically, the sort of progress our satisfied friends allude to when they presume to deride the more radical means of struggle. The cost in emotional turmoil, time, and money, which led to my father's early death as a permanently embittered exile in a foreign country when he saw that after such sacrificial efforts, the Negroes of Chicago were as ghetto-locked as ever, does not seem to figure into their calculations. That is the reality that I am faced with when I now read that some Negroes my own age and younger say that we must now lie down in the streets, tie up traffic, do whatever we can, take to the hills with guns if necessary, and fight back. Fatuous people remark these days on our bitterness. Why, of course, we are bitter.
That's a letter from Lorraine Hansberry to the New York Times 5 years after A Raisin in the Sun. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest Michelle Gordon, along with readers from the UW Odyssey Project. We're talking about Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun. I guess I always have thought of segregation as, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, the South. Chicago, it sounds as if from her letter and from the way it's portrayed in Raisin in the Sun, Chicago was a very violently segregated place to be.
Yes, Chicago was in fact the most violently residentially segregated city in the nation ever.
Why?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I completely have the answer for that, but there was this tremendous fear of black people among whites in Chicago. There was a fear of miscegenation, of race mixing. That's ultimately what it came down to. There was a fear of losing jobs. There was a fear of losing social status by living in the same neighborhood or on the same block as a black family. The real estate agency really had a lot to do with this. They very masterfully established a system of panic in neighborhoods. They would even pay a black woman to walk down a street in a white neighborhood with a stroller. And then a day or two later would send real estate agents knocking on people's doors saying, you know, you really should sell now before property values drop and this whole neighborhood turns over and you've lost your life savings and everything you've worked for. It's really remarkable, but the violence was almost normalized. It was so frequent. And a lot of historians and sociologists really say that sort of the largest amount of urban violence around housing was in the years around 1919, 1920, and 21. And in fact, in Chicago in those years, a bomb went off about every 20 days over housing, either at a real estate agent's office who had sold a house or a black family who had tried to move in. And it's really interesting, you know, in Birmingham, it's so famous when they blew up 16th Street Baptist Church and killed 4 little girls. But children were dying in Chicago in these bombings. It was mostly non-deadly violence, but it did turn deadly, and it was so regular. And when these black families like the Hansberries would move in, you could get up to 10,000 people, white people, freaking out in the streets, burning cars, turning over cars, assaulting black people who happened to be walking within a quarter mile of this tension. There was even a riot where there was a rumor that black people had moved into a neighborhood. This guy actually went to a coworker's house for a union meeting in the neighborhood of Inglewood, which is where Lorraine Hansberry went to high school. And rumors flew around so fast that before you knew it, you had 10,000 people in the streets, and the National Guard had to come in. It took them several days to restore order.
Makes you wonder how important timing was in the production of A Raisin in the Sun. Could it have come out 10 years or 15 or 20 years sooner? Would it have been produced? Would it have been successful?
That's an interesting question. Historically speaking, it could have come out about 10 years earlier and been telling the same story. These race-restrictive covenants that the Hansberries organized to fight with the NAACP were in fact outlawed in 1948 by the Supreme Court in a different case. Their case had been in 1940. And 1949 really marks an incredible upsurge in panic and violence in Chicago and Detroit, Milwaukee also.
So it's just right after the military was integrated.
Yes.
In 48.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of panic about black soldiers coming home as well after World War II, being more assertive. They've just fought these wars for democracy abroad, and really think that this is a way of proving your citizenship or your worthiness of citizenship. The most intense violence over housing in the country was in Chicago between the end of World War II and 1960. And that's exactly the time period that the play set in. If you look at the stage directions, which, you know, comes out in 1959, it says somewhere between World War II and the present. Mm-hmm. So really, it could come after, and it could have come before, but, you know, 1948 or earlier, it would have had to explicitly deal with race-restrictive covenants. Now, in 1975, when Raisin the Musical was in New York, the cast got involved in defending a black family who had moved into a house in Queens who had been bombed out of their house. And upon investigation, they found in 1972 some sort of commission report that indicated that just in the last 18 months, there had been 11 bombings or fires, church attacks, and even a school bus attack just in New York over segregated housing.
Wow, and that was in the 70s.
Yes, 1975.
You know, in the scene that we're about to hear where Mama makes the announcement that she's bought a house in a white neighborhood, she's going to refer to the fact that it costs less to do that. Can
yes.
you say something about the economics here?
Yes. Ghettoization is very exploitive, and it's very profitable for some people, and that's more than a fear of, you know, integration. It's in some ways protecting the ghetto means protecting one's income and one's profits. For example, there was a black family who had lived in the south side of Chicago. It's a family of four. They lived in one half of a two-room flat in the south side, and they paid $56 a month. They then rented an apartment in Cicero, which is just outside of Chicago, five rooms for $60 a month. And in fact, I know that during the Depression and the early 1940s, it cost less per square foot in the Gold Coast, the elite Gold Coast, than it did to rent per square foot in the ghetto. But as I said, these race-restrictive covenants and this violence was very prohibitive. And you really had no way, as you see with the Youngers, you had no way to save up. The ghetto and the rent ate up all of your money. And if you could buy a house in a white neighborhood or rent an apartment, it wasn't necessarily a guarantee that, you know, either you wouldn't be attacked, all your furnishings wouldn't be destroyed, the police might stand by and watch as they burn literally everything you've ever owned and bought for your children.
Well, what you think your grandmama done gone and done with that money?
I don't know, Grandmama.
She went out and bought you a house.
Where is it?
Well, it's out there in Claiborne Park.
Where?
406 Claiborne Street, Claiborne Park.
Claiborne Park? Mama, there ain't no colored people living in Claiborne Park.
Well, I guess there's gonna be some now.
So that's the peace and comfort you've went out and bought for us today?
Son, I just tried to find the nicest place for the least amount of money for my family.
Well, of course, I ain't one never been afraid of no crackers, mind you. But, well, wasn't there no other houses nowhere?
Them houses they put up for colors in them areas way out all seem to cost twice as much as other houses. I did the best I could.
Well, Well, all I can say is, if this is my time in life, my time to say goodbye to these goddamn cracking walls and those marching roaches and this cramped little closet which ain't now or never was no kitchen, then I say it loud and good. Hallelujah and goodbye, misery. I don't never want to see your ugly face again.
Mama seems to have a lot of courage or audacity in, you know, making the decision to move in. Is her view shared throughout the building she lives in?
Not necessarily, and not even within their own family, as we see. One thing I think that's actually really important about Mama and her role here is Ruth says, well, there aren't any colored people living in Clybourne Park. And Mama says, well, they're going to be. And I think that that's one of the most important and revolutionary functions of this play is being able to imagine a different way of living than what people in Chicago or in the nation are currently faced with. And so Mama, even imagining that they can move to Clybourne Park is a really important step towards social change.
Well, and it's like Hansberry's own family as well.
Absolutely. And the whole play she dedicated says to Mama in gratitude for the dream. So I think it's really important while she looks at how younger generations are really pushing in much more radical ways. At the time the play is coming out, it's the eve of the sit-ins, the Montgomery bus boycott's already been going on, Ghana's move towards independence. But she also recognizes that the older generations really have important roles and important inspiration for younger people as well.
One of the scenes that's sometimes cut out of Raisin in the Sun is the one with Mrs. Johnson, the neighbor.
Yes. Well, originally it was cut out for length, but Hansberry really felt like cutting the scene changed the dynamics of the play a lot. And by restoring it, she really clarified a lot of these issues of violence. But also, as you pointed out, you know, these viewpoints of pushing out beyond the ghetto isn't necessarily shared by all the residents of the Southside community. And Mrs. Johnson kind of has these dual roles. She pretends to be excited for the younger. She's very petty, but I also think she delivers some pretty important messages.
Oh, honey, I can't stay hardly a minute. I just dropped in to see if there was anything I could do. I guess y'all seen the news what's all over the colored paper this week.
No, didn't get mine yet this week.
You mean you ain't read about them colored people that was bombed out of their place there? Ain't nothing how bad these here white folks is getting here in Chicago. Lord, getting so you think you right down in Mississippi. Of course, I think it's wonderful how our folks keeps on pushing out. You hear some of these Negroes around here talking about how they don't go nowhere they ain't wanted and all that. But not me, honey. Y'all move to Clybourne Park, Lord. I bet this time next month y'all's name been all around the paper plenty. Negroes moved to Clybourne Park, bombed.
We ain't exactly moving out there to get bombed.
Oh, honey, you know I'm praying to God every day. Don't nothing like that happen. But you have to think of life like it is. And these here Chicago peckerwoods is some bad peckerwoods.
We done thought all about that, Miss Johnson.
The youngers is too much for me. You sure one proud acting bunch of colored folks. Well, I always thinks like Booker T. Washington said that time, education has spoiled many a good plow hand.
Is that what old Booker T. said?
He sure did.
Well, it sounds just like him, the fool.
One of the things that Mrs. Johnson does that's so interesting is compare white people in Chicago and the violence there to Mississippi, which Mississippi, of course, is sort of the penultimate symbol of archaic white supremacy in the United States and may seem like a surprising comparison, but as we've been talking about, you know, there was more violence over housing in Chicago than even Birmingham, Alabama, or anywhere in Mississippi. In some ways, what Hansberry's doing right here by collapsing geographic distinctions is she's creating a larger sense of national black struggle, that segregation is not just a Southern issue, but this is something that blacks in the North face, blacks in the cities face. And so I think that that was an important function. However, she really stays specific and focused on the local, that this is the South Side of Chicago. And other black activists made similar comparisons, but sometimes made mistakes. So when Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference came to Chicago, for example, Reverend James Bevel was really the worker for SCLC who really pushed for them to come to Chicago. And he said, Chicago is just Mississippi moved a few hundred miles north. But that was actually a huge tactical error because it meant he didn't understand, number one, the Daley machine and how that worked, and really didn't understand Daley's divide and conquer system, where you have black politicians who are dependent, in fact, on blocks of black voters, where you have black middle class who've in fact made it and want to protect what they have, even at the expense of other black people, which I think you see with the Murchisons and sort of that disagreement between Walter and George. So that's actually ultimately how and why SCLC failed in their movement in Chicago. And Hansberry doesn't really fall into that trap. It's also interesting, though, because white people in Chicago, even though sort of publicly they wouldn't identify with the racism of Southerners, they really would in terms of the movement. There was an open housing march in the early 1960s in Mayor Daley's neighborhood of Bridgeport, and it was a silent march. Blacks and whites together were marching two by two, and there were small white children standing on the street corner watching them and singing to the tune of the Oscar Mayer Wiener song, "Oh, I wish I were an Alabama trooper, then I could kill Negroes legally." They didn't actually say Negroes, however. And so there really are all of these collapsed distinctions. But Hansberry is very careful not to make that a tactical error, but she really wants to create the sense of national oppression, no matter what Northerners say in public about how open and equal and that there are no laws of segregation here.
Some more aspects of Raisin in the Sun when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, members of the UW Odyssey Project and Michelle Gordon. Our topic, Lorraine Hansberry and her play, A Raisin in the Sun. We've talked a fair amount about the desire to move out of the ghetto in this Chicago, but has any character actually defended that neighborhood, ghetto, whatever you want to call it, as a place somehow to live?
Not in the play, but I think it's important to note that the reason that the family wants to move, or why particularly Mama and Ruth want to move, is because the conditions are unacceptable. There's nothing wrong with the people. There's nothing about the community that makes it undesirable to live in. It's the roaches, it's the rats, which are because, you know, even though you pay taxes, they don't come and pick up your garbage. It's the schools on half-day shifts, which means that your children are not going to be prepared to do much in the workforce beyond minimum wage, right? So not exactly in the play. Now, there is what I think of as kind of a companion piece to A Raisin in the Sun, and that's a novel by Frank London Brown called Trumbull Park. And that was also published in 1959, and it essentially picks up where Raisin leaves off. Frank London Brown was a member of the 10th black family to move out to the housing project in Trumbull Park. And this was possibly the most famous debacle of integration in Chicago that had actually made national news. And the novel begins with a child dying because of a rotten railing on a porch. And so it's really addressing, again, the inequalities and the poor quality of housing in the ghetto. And then they move. And on moving day, they have to have police escort them. And black families sometimes had to have up to 1,000 police officers escorting them into a neighborhood. Your truck might almost be turned over by outraged white housewives, rocks throwing at you, the N-word flying everywhere, pickets outside your house. Then they'd smash your windows. Then they'd set off bombs at precise 30-minute intervals. To get out of the neighborhood, you had to ride in, you know, a police wagon. So it's not like black people just so desperately wanted to go be with these, you know, very friendly white folks in Chicago. It's that black people felt that as taxpayers, as human beings, that they had just as much right to quality housing, to quality education, to healthy environments, to space, for room to breathe.
And they didn't have the wherewithal to actually fix the neighborhood under
right,
those circumstances.
Right. And Brown really addresses, the character really misses the community at the Garner Building. That was the building they had lived in the South Side. And really talks about missing that community and having to listen to the radio to feel connected to black culture and music because they're so isolated out in essentially this very hostile white island. So it wasn't ever an easy decision for any family to make, but really very often for their children they would do it.
Well, it's interesting that the character who does articulate in A Raisin in the Sun the idea of neighborhood, community, the importance of being with people that you get along with is the awful Mr. Linder.
I could say a lot about Mr. Linder before we meet him. He does come across in some ways as very sincere, believing that he's part of an organization that really protects family values and neighborhood sanctity and safety. And in some ways, I think Hansberry thought he really believed that. And we're going to hear in this scene coming up, he actually says that a man should have a right to live in the kind of neighborhood he wants. And it's so interesting because really what he means is a white man, because Walter Lee and the Youngers are very clearly not living under the kinds of conditions they want, but he insists that, in fact, black people are much happier when they live in the ghetto.
I am from the Clybourne Park Improvement Association, and we have had it brought to our attention at the last meeting that you people, or at least your mother, has bought a piece of residential property at 406 Clybourne Street. Well, I don't know how much you folks know about our organization. It's one of those community organizations set up to look after, oh, you know, things like block upkeep and special projects. And we also have what we call our New Neighbors Orientation Committee.
Yes. And what do they do?
Well, it's what you might call a sort of welcoming committee, I guess. I mean, I'm the chairman of the committee, go around and see the new people who move into the neighborhood and sort of give them the lowdown on the way we do things out in Clybourne Park.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a category of what the association calls special community problems.
And what are some of those?
Girl, let the man talk.
Well, to get right to the point, I am sure you people must be aware of some of the incidents which have happened in various parts of the city when colored people have moved into certain areas. Well, because we have what I think is going to be a unique type of organization in American community life, not only do we deplore that kind of thing, but we are trying to do something about it. We feel that most of the trouble in this world, when you get right down to it, most of the trouble exists because people just don't sit down and talk to each other.
You can say that again, mister.
That we don't try hard enough in this world to understand the other fellow's problem, the other guy's point of view.
What do you mean?
Well, you see, our community is made up of people who've worked hard as the dickens for years to build up that little community. They're not rich and fancy people, just hard-working, honest people who don't really have much but those little homes and a dream of the kind of community they want to raise their children in. Now, I don't say we're perfect, and there's a lot wrong in some of the things they want. But you've got to admit that a man, right or wrong, has the right to want to have a neighborhood he lives in a certain kind of way. And at the moment, the overwhelming majority of our people out there feel that people get along better, take more of a common interest in the life of the community when they share a common background. I want you to believe me when I tell you that race prejudice simply doesn't enter into it. It's a matter of the people of Clybourne Park believing, rightly or wrongly, as I say, that for the happiness of all concerned, that our Negro families are happier when they live in their own communities.
This, friends, is the welcoming committee.
Is this what you came marching all the way over here to tell us?
Well, now, we've been having a fine conversation. I hope you'll hear me all the way through.
Go ahead, man.
You see, in the face of all the things I've said, we're prepared to make your family a very generous offer.
30 pieces and not a coin less.
Yeah.
Our association is prepared, through the collective effort of our people, to buy the house from you at a financial gain to your family.
Lord have mercy. Ain't this the living gall?
All right. You through?
Well, I want to give you the exact terms of the financial arrangement.
You never mind how I feel. You got any more to say about how people ought to sit down and talk to each other? Get out of my house, man.
Well, I don't understand why you people are reacting this way. What do you think you're going to gain by moving into a neighborhood where you just aren't wanted and where some elements, well, people can get awful worked up when they feel their whole way of life and everything they've worked for is threatened.
Get out!
Well, I'm sorry it went like this.
Get out!
You just can't force people to change their hearts, son.
Get out!
What we see is Mr. Linder tries to talk a very nice talk. He thinks that, you know, we can settle these differences peacefully, but really the settlement is you stay in your ghetto and I stay in my neighborhood and everything's just fine. And I find it really interesting. He gets so upset. He says, well, we've been having such a nice conversation. And
people get along.
Exactly. But it had basically been a monologue, that he has no real interest in where the Youngers are coming from, even though he insists that that true peaceful resolution is going to come when people really sit down and talk to each other, I think, you know, brother to brother in some way, as he puts it. And he really puts a disgustingly nice spin on what improvement associations really did. They were organizations started in Chicago in the late 19-teens after racial zoning had been outlawed by the Supreme Court. And the Chicago Real Estate Board basically said that, well, there's still a legal way of mutual defense is actually the language they use, and of protecting society, because whites in Chicago, just like white people in Mississippi, were perfectly convinced that, in fact, if there was race mixing, as if we haven't had it since slavery, if there was race mixing, you know, the whole world would go to hell in a handbasket. White civilization would face its downfall. It could be Armageddon. And so they're basically neighborhood organizations that organized to keep black people out. And this was their primary focus. They did worry about things like block upkeep. I mean, Mr. Linder's not lying, but a major part of block upkeep was keeping the blocks all white. And these welcoming committees, it actually did work like this. The first thing that would happen when a black family would buy a piece of property, someone would come visit and say, we'd like to buy it back to you. And it was almost always at a financial gain. If that didn't work, then the mob would come visit you, and that would be the second welcoming committee. And if you didn't leave, they would come back, and they would come back. And so that's really how improvement associations worked. And it was interesting that he said that, you know, it was brought to our attention at the last meeting that you people, and do
yeah,
note how,
a bad sign.
How often he says you, people, bought this. And most of the violence in these neighborhoods actually came almost immediately after improvement association meetings, where they would talk about the dangers of blacks moving into the neighborhood, increased crime, venereal disease, plummeting property values, your white daughters, your wives. You know, it's really a bad scene. And they organize very often in the name of not just family values, but white womanhood. Almost all of the legal suits, like the one that was brought against the Hansberries, was not in the name of the homeowning husband, but almost always in the name of the white wife. And so just like Southerners, they were really using this mantra of protecting white womanhood and our white daughters to prevent integration. And Chicago had actually between 1940 and 1960 became increasingly segregated. Its segregation index was at 96, which means only 4% of the city's tracks were not racially segregated.
You know, Walter is so strong in that scene when he says, get out.
Yes.
But that's going to change, and he's going to call Mr. Linder back.
Yes.
What is it that breaks him down and makes him call Mr. Linder back to reconsider?
Well, you know, you have to think about how much do you want to go live in a community where they think you're an animal and where they're probably going to abuse your son and your wife, possibly, and your mother and
your
sister.
And how much do you need the money?
Right.
Exactly, because you've been paying, you know, all that rent in those rat traps for so long. And so there really is a sense, I think, of absolute fear, but also shame. But it is that shame, ultimately, that makes Walter change his mind when he recognizes that his son is going to see what he does, and he really does change his mind about
that. Does some of that shame come from the fact that Walter has invested, in effect? He's the one who wants to invest in the liquor store.
Yes.
So he's going to partner with some sort of shady black characters, one of whom then runs off with his $6,500.
Right, right.
So there has to be some embarrassment,
absolutely,
at the very least, in that.
Absolutely. You know, he's lost his sister's college money. And so in some ways, it seems like the quick fix. And again, Walter Lee is not that eager to go live with white people. You know, in some ways, taking the money and staying where you are and living in perhaps a little bit more economic comfort is in some ways appealing.
Well, let's listen to the scene when Walter is planning to tell Mr. Linder that he's going to take the money, but something happens.
Well, I certainly was glad to hear from you people. Life can really be so much simpler than people let it be most of the time. Well, with whom do I negotiate? You, Mrs. Younger, or your son here? Just some official papers, Sonny.
Travis, you go downstairs.
No. Travis, you stay right here. And you make him understand what you're doing, Walter Lee. You teach him good, like Willie Harris taught you. You show where I five generations done come to. Go ahead, son. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Linder, we called you because, well, me and my family, well, we are very plain people.
Yes.
I mean, I have worked as a chauffeur most of my life, and my wife here, She does domestic work in people's kitchen. So does my mother. I mean, we are plain people.
Yes, Mr. Younger.
And, well, my father, well, he was a laborer most of his life.
Yes, yes, I understand.
And my father almost beat a man to death once. This man called him a bad name or something. You know what I mean?
No, no, I'm afraid I don't.
Yeah, well, what I mean is that we come from people who had a lot of pride. I mean, we are very proud people. And that's my sister over there, and she's going to be a doctor. And we are very proud.
Well, I'm sure that is very nice, but...
What I'm telling you is that we called you over here to tell you that we are very proud and that this... Travis, come here. This is my son, and he makes the sixth generation of our family in this country, and we have all thought about your offer.
Well, good, good.
And we have decided to move into our house because my father, he earned it for us brick by brick. We don't want to make no trouble for nobody or fight no causes, and we'll try to be good neighbors, and that's all we've got to say about that. We don't want your money.
I take it, then, that you've decided to occupy.
That's what the man said.
Then I would like to appeal to you, Mrs. Younger. You're older and wiser and understand things better, I am sure.
I'm afraid you don't understand. My son said we was going to move and there ain't nothing left for me to say. You know how these young folks is nowadays, mister. Can't do a thing with them. Goodbye.
Well... If you were that final about it, there's nothing left for me to say. I sure hope you people know what you're getting into.
Well, for God's sake, if the moving men are here, let's get the hell out of here.
That part of Mr. Lindner, as a director or as an actor, do you have to play him as somebody who is just devious and hiding all his cards, or can you play him as somebody who actually believes much of what he's saying and is just naive?
I think to be real, you have to play him as someone who believes, as you put it, much of what he's saying. He doesn't believe everything he's saying. He really uses a lot of language to cover up, for example, the violence. You know, people can get awfully worked up, right? Well, it means people can blow up your house. People can shatter all of your windows. So, yes and no. It's you know, Hansberry and other writers of the period, like James Baldwin, writers of our time like Toni Morrison, really talk about white Americans' willful ignorance. And it's that you don't acknowledge what you don't want to see and what you don't want to know. And you even hear Linder saying, really has a problem assigning responsibility to himself for his actions, because he knows it's shameful. He knows it's wrong, but he also knows that he wants to keep his neighborhood white, and he probably is very genuinely afraid of what's going to happen. And so many working-class white families in Chicago lost their life savings because real estate agents made property values plummet as soon as blacks moved into the neighborhood. Families could sell their house for $10,000, $20,000 less than it was worth. Real estate agents would then turn around and maybe even double the price before selling it to black families. So, you know, there really was a fear of loss.
So, in a sense, what he's saying about, well, racism doesn't have anything to do with it, that could be true to the extent that people say, well, I don't care what color they are moving in here. I don't want to lose my property values.
I don't think you could ever say that it's true that racism doesn't have anything to do with it. I think you and I both know whenever someone says race is not the issue here,
that's a preamble for saying
that's
that
exactly what they mean.
Yeah. Well, and anytime you say you people.
Yes.
It's not.
it's a very clear separation. I do not identify with you. You are distinctly different from me. And, you know, as we talked about with Linder saying a man has a right, he doesn't even acknowledge, you know, the full humanity of the Younger family.
What kind of reaction did Hansberry get from people of her time when this play was performed?
She got quite a varied reaction. A lot of white people loved the play and thought it was great and kind of did this willful ignorance thing where they just pretended that the violence wasn't there. It was a lot easier when that scene with Mrs. Johnson was cut. But Ruth does, in fact, refer to bombs going off several times, including the very first scene of the play, you know, in the newspaper that they set off another bomb. But I actually have a letter here from Lorraine Hansberry, a woman named Miss Oler had written to her and seemed to have some problems with the way that Hansberry had treated Mr. Linder. And she also seemed to have some problems. She thought Hansberry was being overly idealistic, and she also urged Hansberry and basically Black Americans to wait for, quote, the hearts of individuals to change, saying, be patient. Hansberry basically said in the play and publicly everywhere, well, since 1619, you know, we've been doing everything we can to get free. And the charge of impatience, she said, is literally unbearable. My dear Miss Oler, let us please be quite clear about one thing. I have treated Mr. Linder as a human being merely because he is one. That does not make the meaning of his call less malignant or less sick. I could no more imagine myself allowing the Youngers to accept his obscene offer of money than I could imagine myself allowing them to accept a cash payment for their own murder. You seem to wish to quarrel with me about what you consider fuzzy-headed notions of idealism. I absolutely plead guilty to the charge of idealism. You see, our people don't really have a choice. We must come out of the ghettos of America, because the ghettos are killing us. Not only our dreams, as Mama says, but our very bodies. It is not an abstraction to us that the average American Negro has a life expectancy of 5 to 10 years less than the average white. You see, Miss Oler, that is murder, and a Negro writer cannot be expected to share the placid view of the situation that might be the case with the white writer. As for changing the hearts of individuals, I am glad the American nation did not wait for the hearts of individual slave owners to change to abolish the slave system, for I suspect that I should still be running around on a plantation as a slave, and that really would not do. Sincerely, Lorraine Hansberry.
In the title of the play, what does the raisin refer to?
Well, that comes from a Langston Hughes poem, Harlem, which is in his montage of A Dream Deferred. And the essential question of the poem is, what happens to a dream deferred? And one of the options is that it dries up like a raisin in the sun. Another option, and it comes out as a question at the end of the poem, is, or does it explode? And I think that this was part of the warning and the prophecy of the play. She's telling both Black and white Americans that we cannot go on as we are, that segregation does not work. It will not be accepted by Black America any longer. And she was, in fact, right. You know, not that long after the play hit Broadway, you started having Watts riots and riots in Detroit and Chicago and Cleveland and everywhere else you could possibly imagine. And that really, in some ways, was the beginning of the end, that there was this tremendous white flight and retreat from the inner cities. You began to have deindustrialization. And so it was really frightfully prophetic in a lot of ways. But she's really saying that everyone needs to think about what happens when human beings' dreams are really deferred, and deferred because of exploitive capitalism and white supremacy.
Michelle Gordon, thank you for being our guest on University of the Year.
Thank you for having me.
And we also want to thank our readers today from the UW Odyssey Project, posing as Mr. Linder, but definitely not that way in real life, Coach Marshall Cook, professor in the Department of Liberal Studies. Also from the UW Odyssey Project, Tillman Morris, Annette Bland, Yasmin Horton, Brian Benford, and Aroki Rice. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.